You could drink as much of those substances as you want, not going to hurt you at all, except for the fact that your liver is going to turn it into something else. And that's where we get into problems. So for methanol, for example, methanol gets turned into formaldehyde in the body and then to formic acid. And formic acid, that breakdown product, that is what causes the blindness. That is what causes problems in your brain that can lead to diseases like Parkinson's. And that is what can cause a profound acidemia that can kill you.
Here you on 8. Here you on 8. Okay, you're clear. Stand by for your base.
Welcome to EMS Cast, where we provide high-level education for you, the providers on the streets. I'm your host, Ross Orpit, a emergency physician here in Southwest Colorado, and I have with me my co-host,
Will Berry. Good to see you again, Ross. I am a paramedic here in North Carolina, currently working in a critical care flight capacity.
And today we have back with us our toxicologist, Nick Matzler, who's going to be talking to us about alcohol, but not any alcohol, specifically the toxic kinds of alcohol. Before we get into that, I would just love to know, what is everybody drinking tonight? Because I am enjoying a lovely IPA from Greeley, Colorado, Weldworks. Nick, what are you drinking?
I have the pleasure of drinking a IPA as well from Portland, Oregon, from a brewery called Breakside, one of my absolute favorites.
Shocking. I could have guessed that before you even mentioned it.
That's right.
Will, what are you drinking?
Currently, I am drinking a seltzer water, but the last delicious beer I had that we just finished was also a dark IPA from an awesome brewery in Durham, North Carolina.
Will, if I asked you to go get some alcohol right now to drink with us, since we're going to be talking about toxic alcohols, could you?
No, but maybe after this education session with Nick, I could find a good surrogate.
I was going to say that there might be some alcohols you're just not aware of in your house. So today we're going to be talking about toxic alcohol. So not your standard mill beer, whiskey, vodka, alcohol that just gets you drunk, but we're talking about the alcohol that's found in other household products and causes problems. So Nick, what's different about toxic alcohols from our standard, you know, beer that you and I are drinking right now?
That's a great question. And a lot of it has to do with what the alcohol breaks down into. And so I think I got to take one quick step back. When we use the term toxic alcohols, I think it is personally the best term to describe this group of xenobiotics that we're going to talk about. But some toxicologists are going to get mildly upset by the term toxic alcohol. And there's two reasons for that. The first reason has to do with the old adage from our good friend Paracelsus that dose makes the poison, meaning that not all toxic alcohols are going to be toxic to you unless you take a high enough dose of it. So in other words, it may not be, quote, as toxic as you think. The other component of it is actually not all the things that we're going to talk about today are actually alcohols, even though we think of them colloquially as, a, quote, an alcohol. For example, ethylene glycol is not an alcohol, it's a glycol. And so sometimes the term toxic alcohols is a little bit of a misnomer, but I think it is still the easiest way to quickly describe and get everybody on the exact same page as to what you're talking about.
Okay, so when we refer to the toxic alcohols, I guess, what are the different kinds and where can we commonly find them?
The big three that people consider are methanol, ethylene glycol, and isopropyl alcohol. Now, that third one, isopropyl, doesn't always get looped into the group because it technically doesn't break down into anything that is more toxic for you than, let's say, just regular ethanol. However, the age-old adage for isopropyl ingestion is twice as drunk, twice as long, because it takes quite a bit longer to break down that alcohol compared to regular old ethanol that you'd find in beer, wine, or spirits. And it can be a little bit hard on the stomach. It can be a little bit more noxious, if you will. And so the folks that drink it, they tend to stay intoxicated for longer. And it's also a heavier alcohol. And one of the themes that we're going to talk about is, well, as the molecule gets bigger, as it becomes heavier, it actually makes you more intoxicated. So isopropyl is sort of its own beast, but often one that doesn't require any different treatment than just good old-fashioned ethanol intoxication.
I notice a theme And from a chemistry perspective, and that's the suffix, the ethanol, methanol. What exactly is an alcohol? And can you make it simple for my street paramedic brain to comprehend?
Absolutely, because it has to be simple for me too, my friend. So an alcohol in general is just a molecule that has an OH group. So in other words, an oxygen molecule and a hydrogen molecule bound to a string of carbons is considered an alcohol. And then there's other types of molecules, like ethylene glycol is a glycol molecule, and it essentially just doesn't have that same group. It just doesn't have that same OH group on the end of it. But if you take any length of carbon chain and you add an OH group to it, you are now going to be an alcohol. And so ethanol, for example, is two carbons and an OH group, and that's what makes it ethanol. And the only difference between ethanol, which is tasty when you enjoy responsibly, the only difference between that and methanol is one carbon. So methanol is simply just one carbon bound to an OH group. So that OH group is what makes something an alcohol, and the number of carbons that are involved in it is what's going to make it heavier or lighter overall, and it's the difference between the ethanol and the methanol.
Got it. Cool. Thanks.
And with regards to these three main toxic alcohols that you mentioned, where might we find each of these?
That is a great question, because I think this is going to be one of the most important things, especially from a pre-hospital perspective, is what are you going to be watching out for when you encounter these patients? So for ethylene glycol, for example, this is often one of the substances that we think about in like antifreeze and other products that need to have a lower freezing point overall. Now, you can find ethylene glycol in many other places as well. Some of like the DOT 3 and 4 brake fluids, for example, will sometimes contain these kinds of substances. So it's oftentimes involved in things that are for automotive care and manufacturing, and you will find it in some industrial applications as well. Now, methanol is a little bit more widely spread because there's a few extra applications of it. So methanol, again, we find it in like windshield wiper fluid. You could also theoretically use it a little bit as like a type of antifreeze. You can use it as a propellant. And then it's found in things like carburetor cleaner and some other kind of interesting places, like, for example, Sterno or these other kinds of flame that are used for like chafing dishes and things like that will contain some amount of methanol. And believe it or not, people sometimes ingest Sterno, and that can be a consideration for methanol poisoning. And so it's good to review some of these places that we might find it, so that when you encounter a patient who is lying next to a can of Sterno, you might have the forethought to say, gosh, this might be a toxic alcohol ingestion.
Why do people ingest these?
Oftentimes, the big categories are accidental and intentional self-harm. In the form of accidental, you get people who are either trying to become intoxicated and they accidentally picked a substance that may either contain some ethanol, but then also contains one of these toxic alcohols, or it's like a pediatric patient and it's an exploratory ingestion where they're crawling around the garage and accidentally drink something. You know, ethylene glycol has kind of a sweet taste to it. And so sometimes animals or young children will get into it. And then my favorite accidental that seems to pop up all the time is the good old swig from a Gatorade bottle. It is insanely common that we get calls from people that say, gosh, you know, I was working out in my garage and I reached over to take a drink of my Gatorade. I picked up the bottle. I took a big couple of gulps before I realized, wait, that tastes funny. And then I look at it and wouldn't you know, it's the Gatorade bottle that I used to store my antifreeze. It's not the Gatorade bottle that I'd brought out to drink out of. Always shocking to me, but apparently people love to store things in Gatorade bottles in their garage and take swigs from it. And then of course, there's the intentional self-harm and folks that are, you know, looking to harm themselves and have easy access to these substances and then use them as a potential poison.
Do these alcohols have any effects that people find desirable? Would people drink these as a replacement for ethanol?
It absolutely will have effects. And as we alluded to a little bit earlier, the heavier a molecule is, the more intoxicating effect you will have. So ethylene glycol, for example, ethylene glycol is heavier than regular ethanol, and so it's actually more intoxicating than regular ethanol is. And so people may potentially get benefit out of this if the goal is to become intoxicated. But I have to admit, not a lot of people are drinking these on purpose to become intoxicated. It's more that they were seeking out an alternative source of alcohol, and it just so happens to accidentally contain one of these toxic alcohols. One of the most interesting things that I've seen is that there is something called denatured alcohol. And what the heck is that? Denatured alcohol is just an alcohol product, but they have added methanol to it on purpose. So essentially, like if you are a chemistry lab and you want to work with very pure ethanol, you can order, instead of ethanol, denatured alcohol. The reason you would do this as a lab is because ethanol, even like high lab grade, like very pure ethanol, if it is just pure ethanol, technically could still be consumed, and therefore it is subject to taxing as a ethanol product, just like beer or wine would be. And so to skirt that regulation, what they do is they actually intentionally add methanol to the product, so that way it's no longer available technically for human consumption and therefore not subject to those same tax restrictions. And so sometimes people get into trouble when they see the denatured alcohol and they're like, oh great, I've got like, you know, over 90 proof alcohol, or 90% alcohol, I should say. So over like 180 proof. And then people drink this substance not realizing that it has methanol in it. And so there's all these kinds of sneaky ways that people might get it. But I think rarely people are saying, ah, yeah, I'm going to intentionally get intoxicated. I want the effect from ethylene glycol over regular ethanol. I think it's mainly people seeking ethanol that are accidentally getting the toxic byproduct. And there is one caveat to that that we can talk about too.
So first, I guess, why is this topic important to our pre-hospital providers?
That has a little bit to do with how difficult this can be to diagnose in the hospital setting. So when we think about toxic alcohols, a lot of hospitals, even big academic hospitals, have a hard time testing for these substances in the blood. Now, tests readily exist for them, but oftentimes they're what we call send-out labs, meaning that when you come into the hospital and anybody brings up the suspicion for a toxic alcohol ingestion, we have to draw a blood sample and we have to send it to a lab in a different state, and it can take several days before that comes back. And that is a problem because it means, you know, increased rates of hospitalization, it can mean overtreatment, it can mean all sorts of different bad outcomes for the patient. So from a pre-hospital setting, if we have a high index of suspicion, then finding one of these substances on the premises can really help us, or the lack of finding one of these substances on the premises can really help guide our care when somebody comes to the hospital. I think the other thing is too, is that, you know, some of the sickest patients I've seen, the only reason that we caught it early enough to save the patient's life was because EMS figured it out for us and essentially gift wrapped the case for us. It's things like, hey, this, you know, undomiciled individual was found down in somebody's garage. And when we found this person, gosh, there was a few bottles around them, and we brought these bottles in. And then as we're looking at the bottles, we're like, yep, these contain a bunch of methanol. And so it instantly let us solve the case right then and there. And so, you know I harp on this every time you guys allow me to come yammer on your show, but looking for like the pill bottles, looking for the substances that are on the scene can really help us in the emergency department get us to the right answer.
Yeah, I mean, these are incredibly difficult cases to diagnose because it can just look like intoxication or altered mental status. And truly the only thing that keys you into this is a history or something that pre-hospital providers found on scene that might point towards this.
I 100% agree.
Nick, I wanted to bring up some other products that I know contain alcohol, and I wanted to ask you about those. So I'll set up a few cases here. First was a gentleman we got called to for intoxication who was found shoplifting, and we found a bunch of bottles of vanilla extract on him and in his bags. And I know that vanilla extract contains an alcohol in it. And then another case that I had was for family that called EMS for another like live-in family member they had that had sort of fallen on hard times. She had just come back from rehab and she had been drinking hairspray and said she learned that in rehab because they didn't have access to ethanol, like conventional alcohol there. So what's up with hairspray and vanilla extract?
Absolutely. I think that's a really good question. I think exactly as you're getting up, it's bringing up these like ethanol containing alternatives for the ethanol enthusiast out there. The folks that are addicted to ethanol in general, and when they have a hard time getting a hold of alcohol, I mean, we've all seen what alcohol withdrawal can look like. And so these people will obviously seek out ways to get ethanol, even if they can't either afford to buy alcohol, they don't have a ready source. And so things like the hairspray, the extracts, the hand sanitizers, all of these things are things that people will go after to try to become intoxicated. And so the vanilla extract or extracts in general are very interesting. These can contain a wide variety in terms of amounts of ethanol. And vanilla extract very commonly contains 35% alcohol, which, you know, when you think about that, that's about the same as a 70 proof shot of vodka overall. And we see this in both people who are intentionally trying to obtain ethanol and become intoxicated. We also see it in like pediatric exploratory ingestions when they're like, you know, smell the vanilla extract or any of these extracts like orange or anything else. And they smell it. It smells good. They drink a little bit of it. And you can imagine that as a pretty strong alcohol substance, that that can make a pediatric patient fairly intoxicated because of their size. And then certainly for people that are purposely seeking this out, you know, obviously those extracts are very expensive overall, but we do see a lot of people shoplift them. They're very easy to shoplift. And sometimes you can find actually pretty large bottles of these extracts. And then absolutely other things like hairsprays and hand sanitizers all potentially contain alcohols, and people will ingest these substances looking to become intoxicated. And most of the time, the main thing you have to worry about is just the ethanol itself. There are sometimes some caveats in terms of other chemicals that might be mixed in these products that we need to worry about. But in general, what I find is they're just a little bit more caustic than regular alcohol. So you might see more gastritis, you might see more nausea and vomiting, but oftentimes it's mostly just the effects of the ethanol that you're going to see. And of course, there's a few caveats, like I'm sure we're going to talk about hand sanitizer a little bit more here, and we'll talk about some caveats with that. But a lot of these other products, they just contain straight ethanol with a few other chemicals that aren't necessarily going to hurt you that much, but will cause more profound, like caustic injury, like gastritis and nausea and vomiting and things like that.
So you've said that these patients appear more intoxicated. What's the problem with that? I mean, they got the effect they wanted, right? They just got really drunk.
Yeah, I guess what Will is getting at is like, what makes these poisonous?
So when we're talking about products that contain straight ethanol, of course, we run into certain problems with ethanol itself. I mean, obviously, you can become so intoxicated that, you know, you can't protect your own airway, or you can get alcohol ketoacidosis. So there's all the problems of ethanol that we've talked about in the past on ethanol withdrawal. But the problem with the toxic alcohol specifically is what they break into. So the parent compound, meaning when we talk about methanol and ethylene glycol, and I say the parent compound, I mean literally the molecule that is methanol and the molecule that is ethylene glycol. Those molecules, they are intoxicating, and interestingly, they're totally safe. Like ethylene glycol and methanol, totally fine. No problems with them whatsoever. You could drink as much of those substances as you want, not going to hurt you at all, except for the fact that your liver is going to turn it into something else. And that's where we get into problems. So for methanol, for example, methanol gets turned into formaldehyde in the body and then to formic acid. And formic acid, that breakdown product, that is what causes the blindness. That is what causes problems in your brain that can lead to diseases like Parkinson's. And that is what can cause a profound acidemia that can kill you. Similarly, ethylene glycol, it breaks down into glycolic acid and oxalic acid. And these are the components that cause the kidney injury, the acidosis, and can potentially lead to fatal outcomes or long-term morbidity in the form of permanent kidney injury. And so the parent compounds, very safe, But when the body looks at those parent compounds, it's going to try to break them down. And the problem is that these parent compounds look enough like regular ethanol that the molecule that breaks down ethanol, called alcohol dehydrogenase, the enzyme that breaks down alcohol dehydrogenase will also act on methanol and ethylene glycol. And when it acts on these substances, it starts the cascade of metabolizing them into their toxic byproducts. So if you just have the parent compound in your system, no problem. You're just going to be good old-fashioned intoxicated. But if your body is allowed to break these substances down as it wants to, that is when you're going to start getting harmed.
So it sounds like, Nick, you're alluding that if we can just prevent these or prevent our body from breaking these down into their toxic components, that in and of themselves, they're harmless.
You're exactly right. If we can prevent this conversion, then we can actually keep patients safe. And then depending on how much was allowed to convert before we got to them, we may actually not have to do much more than that. Let's say you accidentally took a big swig of your antifreeze and you get a big old dose of ethylene glycol, or if you drank a different product, like a big dose of methanol. It's going to take several hours for that product to turn into the toxic components. And in fact, you know, kind of joked about earlier in terms of the dose makes the poison, you know, if you were to drink a tiny bit of methanol or a tiny bit of ethylene glycol, it actually won't really cause any harm to you whatsoever. Your body will, you know, break it down into toxic components, but those will be further detoxified and your body won't even feel any ill effects from it overall. However, when you get a lot of it in your system, if we allow it to convert into the toxic byproduct, then absolutely you're going to see harm. But it does take a few hours overall. And so when patients first present, they might be a patient that looks ethanol intoxicated to you. And if you get an ethanol level, you might get an unexpected finding where you're like, oh, it's not actually elevated. They have no ethanol in their system, but they still look like they're intoxicated. That's something where you might say, oh, that's a clue that maybe they've drinking another intoxicating substance that's similar overall. Now, when your body starts to break these substances down, as we talked about before, it's done through an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, which is the enzyme that breaks down regular ethanol. And what's interesting about that is that because it's designed essentially in the body to break down ethanol, it binds much more tightly to the ethanol itself compared to these toxic alcohols. So in fact, it's one of my favorite antidotes to any poison out there. But if you were to drink methanol or ethylene glycol, the antidote that you could use is the good old IPA that you have in front of you, Ross. And if you drank enough of it and became intoxicated enough on that ethanol, then your enzyme, your alcohol dehydrogenase, would say, wow, there's a whole bunch of regular ethanol. I much prefer to break that substance down. So let me attack that substance. And as it is busy breaking down the regular ethanol, the ethylene glycol, you will just pee out into the world, and the methanol, you will breathe out through your lungs. And over time, this is a way to treat patients. And so actually for a long time, the way we treated patients was we literally gave them alcohol. And so if you came into the emergency department and you had accidentally ingested one of these substances, we would either have you drink alcohol or we would give you IV alcohol as a way to treat you for this problem overall. Nowadays, we have a different medication called fomepizole. And fomepizole is a special molecule that's designed to bind to alcohol dehydrogenase, block it, and prevent the conversion without the intoxicating side effects of regular old ethanol.
These incredibly toxic effects you described, so injury to the liver, injury to the kidney, do you see these with a single poisoning event?
Yes. So if you take a big old swig of either of these ones that we've been talking about, mainly the methanol, the ethylene glycol, you can absolutely see profound effects. What's going to happen is that after you drink it, you're going to start to feel intoxicated. And as time goes on, the parent compound will be metabolized into the toxic byproduct. And as the toxic byproduct accumulates, you will start to have more acid in your blood. So you will start to become more acidemic. You will see the usual things that you see when a patient is acidemic. So you will see an increased respiratory rate. So there's going to be respiratory compensation from it. And as the acidemia worsens, you might see cardiac effects like hypotension, tachycardia, and the like. Each one of these toxins is then going to have their own individual effects on you. So for ethylene glycol, outside of the acidemia, we see effects on the kidneys predominantly, where it forms crystals in the kidneys and it can cause profound kidney injury that's either reversible or sometimes, unfortunately, permanent. So it can take you from normal renal function to I need dialysis every day. Methanol, it tends to affect the brain and the eyes. And so methanol, its toxic metabolite, formic acid, will make you go blind, potentially, and then will affect your brain to the point where you can see bleeding in areas of the brain that are similar to when you have Parkinson's disease. And so it can actually induce a Parkinson's-like disease in you when you ingest this kind of a substance if you survive your ingestion overall. So each will have their own special organ they affect, but broadly, they will cause that acidemia that can kill you on its own.
Wow. Yeah, that's a significant poisoning event.
So describe the setups for these patients. I guess, like, what should we be looking for? What is a patient going to look like? What physical exam findings might we find?
So when you see a patient who's in DKA, right, you see them, they're breathing quickly. They might have a depressed level of consciousness. They're going to be tachycardic. They might be a little hypotensive. And that's going to be a very similar thing to these toxic alcohols if they've already transitioned from the parent compound to the toxic metabolite. So when these patients very first ingest the substance, they're going to look regular, old, intoxicated. Now, methanol, interestingly, it's the lightest of these substances. So methanol is not super intoxicating. So you have to drink quite a bit of it to get the same effects as even, like, you know, several drinks of ethanol. But all of these will make you intoxicated appearing during the initial phase of the poisoning. And so patients will have slurred speech, they'll have gait instability, they'll have all the normal things that you see when you just see regular old ethanol intoxicated patients. And as time goes on, you might see their respiratory rate start to increase as they become acidemic. You might see their heart rate increase as a compensatory mechanism. You might start to see that hypotension develop in patients. And that can clue you in that they're starting to transition from the good old intoxicated phase to now the more poisonous phase.
And how much of each of these does it take to actually be concerning for, like, poisonous toxic effects?
That's a great question. It really depends on the concentration of the product that you drink. So as an example, have you ever used, like, the windshield wiper fluid in your car? You know, you press a little lever and, like, it sprays your car and everything else like that?
Of course.
Yes, very familiar.
You have both been methanol poisoned then in the past.
I did not drink it.
I did not drink it, Nick. I know it looked like Kool-Aid, but I did not drink said Kool-Aid.
Well, what's fascinating is that, you know, so far we've talked about ingestion as a route of exposure, but inhalation is a route of exposure as well. And the reason I bring this up is because they've actually done a fascinating study where they took regular old people, they put them in a regular old car that didn't have any problems with it. And when you activate your windshield wiper fluid and spray it on your car windshield, transiently, there's an increase in the amount of methanol that's in your cabin compartment. And we can actually detect that in you. You are transiently methanol toxic. Now, it's not truly toxic. I'm blowing it out of proportion a little bit. It's just that we can detect a little methanol in you. But one of the primary ways we get rid of methanol is by breathing it out. And so what happens is you just transiently breathe a little bit in and you breathe a little bit back out and you never come to harm from that overall. And so it really comes back to this dose makes the poison. It depends on the concentration of the product overall. And if it's a highly concentrated product and you have a few sips, you're going to be into trouble. If it's a less concentrated product, you might be able to drink more bulk of it without getting into trouble. But you can also, we've seen industrial accidents where people essentially, for lack of a better story, fall into like a vat of methanol and it absorbs through the skin and you can become toxic through absorption in the skin. We also famously have seen people that Huff carburetor cleaner that oftentimes has methanol. And the reason I say famously is Ross and I had a very well-known patient to the Denver Health Emergency Department that used to Huff carburetor cleaner and come in all the time after using it. And sometimes he required treatment for methanol toxicity. And sometimes, remarkably, even though he had huffed an enormous amount of it, was just fine from that component. And so it was a really fascinating patient to see recurrently in the emergency department.
So obviously any sort of industrial ingestion, we're going to immediately worry about it because the concentrations are likely going to be high. But what about your household products? So your antifreeze, your windshield wiper fluid, how much of these ingestions do you need to be concerning and toxic?
From that perspective, usually just a swallow or a few swallows. In the realm of tox, we've actually done studies to see like, well, what is an average swallow? Like how many ounces does that have for like a pediatric patient or an adult patient? But even just like a mouthful of either one of these substances is potentially enough to make you toxic. So even if you took one swig of methanol, like from like a windshield wiper fluid or anything else like that, that potentially is enough to lead to true toxicity. And so the problem is that it's almost impossible to know until we get the laboratory tests and do some of the maneuvers that we can talk about in a minute. And so when we have these patients come in, like anytime, like if you call me on the phone at the poison center and say, hey, we have an adult or child that accidentally took a swig of one of these substances, I would say, yeah, you got to go into the hospital. We got to monitor you. We got to do the tests because it may be totally fine. And again, you can have a small concentration of methanol or ethylene glycol in your system. And if it's small enough, we may not have to do anything. Your body's just going to handle it. But until we actually get some blood work on you, it is almost impossible for us to know. And I think that's a really good lesson when I think one of the hard things as EMS providers is when you're, you know, doing a refusal. And how can you accurately guide a patient in terms of the risks and benefits of their decision-making process? And so if you see one of these exposures and, you know, somebody's like, ah, yeah, I guess I had a swig of this, but I'm not too worried about it. Maybe I'll stay at home. This is something where you can say, well, actually, we know that even a sip of this might be enough to cause you significant morbidity and mortality. And so really, you ought to come to the hospital so we can check you out and keep you safe.
Yeah, it's really good to know because we often think, a little sip, it's probably fine. But even that can be toxic. Do we have any treatments or I guess what do we do for these patients pre-hospitally? Other than we talked about the most important thing is to recognize and find the clues and notify the emergency department.
As with a lot of tox, unfortunately, especially in the pre-hospital setting, the main guiding principle I can say is supportive care. Fluids are going to help if we can dilute it out a little bit and encourage the elimination. So for ethylene glycol, for example, ethylene glycol famously hurts the kidneys. If we can help flush it through the kidneys a little bit better, then we're going to decrease the chance of kidney damage. And for any of these substances, if we can dilute it out a little bit, that's going to be helpful. So giving patients some fluids. And then it's going to be the recognition that if patients are getting really sick from these substances, that you need to be a little bit more careful. So I know that you and Matt had a great episode where you talked about, you know, the physiologically challenging airway. And this is one I'd lump into that category. If you're real sick from a toxic alcohol, you're going to be real acidemic. And it comes along with those same dangers of like, gosh, we need to protect your airway. But at the same time, when we take away your respiratory drive, when we paralyze you to intubate you, even those brief moments can skyrocket your CO2, dump your pH, and lead to terrible outcomes. And so it's one of those things where you might want to think twice about RSIing a patient if you think they're protecting their airway. If you're on the fence and you're like, oh, I think they're doing okay from an airway perspective, but I'm uncomfortable with it, this is one where I'd almost let it ride a little bit more if they have an appropriately elevated respiratory rate. If they're tiring out, absolutely, they need to be tubed or they're going to die. But if they have an appropriately elevated respiratory rate, they're Kussmaul breathing, you think they're protecting their airway, even though they're, you know, probably obtunded, that's one that I'd probably let ride a little bit longer as opposed to trying to take the airway because that can be extremely dangerous with their acidemia. And so a lot of it is get good access, recognize the disease process and what might complicate the resuscitative measures you're going to take. give some fluids if it's appropriate for that patient to help dilute things out, get it through the kidneys, and then collect the evidence on scene to bring it to the hospital.
Yeah, Nick is referring to the episode 24 from May 2022, the physiologically difficult airway, part 3, severe metabolic acidosis. So refer to that if you do feel like you need to manage a patient's airway with metabolic acidosis.
Is vomiting a problem for these patients? And what I mean by that is you hear about some caustic ingestions that are problematic as they come back up. And then also, what about activated charcoal? I think there are probably still some EMS providers around the country that have access to that. And is that something that can be beneficial?
Will, these are both great questions, and thank you for bringing it up because I have completely neglected to talk about it. You're 100% right that some of these alcohols are going to be more caustic, and especially depending on what they're mixed with. So the hairsprays, the isopropyl, some of these other things like the vanilla extracts, some of these can be pretty caustic to the esophagus and the stomach. We don't often see full caustic injury like we might with the extremes of pH. So lye ingestion or other kinds of acid ingestion, are going to cause profound injury to the esophagus and the stomach. But these toxic alcohols can certainly cause pretty rip-roaring gastritis. Isopropyl alcohol famously causes what we call a hemorrhagic gastritis. So patients might be throwing up, and they might be throwing up blood when you see them. And it can certainly cause esophageal injury. So you're absolutely right on that point that we need to consider those substances. And when you see these patients, they might require ondansetron for some nausea control. And when you see them throwing up, especially if they're throwing up blood, it may not be quite the same emergency as somebody that's bleeding from varices, but it's something to keep in the back of your mind on the differential when you're seeing somebody who's vomiting blood. It's do they have profound gastritis from some sort of ingestion they had? And certainly toxic alcohol is one of the things that can cause that as well. From the charcoal perspective, any liquid that you're ingesting usually is not going to be a good candidate for charcoal in general, because we think of them as absorbing so quickly that charcoal is probably not going to be able to get in and do anything. Now, there's some caveats to that overall, but in general, we would say probably this is one of those things that we do not need to use charcoal for. If you had concern that there was co-ingestion, like another medication they took or another xenobiotic or poison that you're worried about, it would certainly be reasonable to say, let's give them a dose of charcoal more for the other substance. However, in these patients, I would say because it can cause a lot of nausea and vomiting, and we know that it's unlikely to improve patients' outcomes or bind to the toxic alcohol itself once you ingest it, then I would say it's probably something I would avoid in these patients if you think they're just straight methanol, ethylene glycol, isopropyl, etc.
Cool, thanks. We've hinted around isopropyl alcohol quite a bit, but we haven't seemed to focus on that. And specifically, it's really the main ingredient in hand sanitizer, if I'm not mistaken. So what's different about it? What's the big deal there?
This has to do with, some of the misnomer of toxic alcohols, because the parent compound, isopropyl, is not necessarily toxic itself outside of the intoxicating effects that you see. But when it breaks down, it also doesn't really break down into anything that's terribly toxic. It breaks down into acetone, so essentially fingernail polish. And acetone can sometimes give you a false positive for ketones in your blood or urine, and in high quantities can sometimes cause some small problems. But for the most part, acetone is not that dangerous of a substance. And so isopropyl in general, outside of causing stomach upset, this hemorrhagic gastritis that we sometimes see, and of course, the fairly profound intoxication, e.g. the twice as drunk, twice as long kind of mnemonic that we use for it, isopropyl just doesn't tend to cause that much grief. And so when we see patients like this, I do definitely think about caustic injury in them. But most of the time I think, okay, your stomach's going to be upset. Let's give you good nausea control. And then other than that, I'm going to treat you mostly like I'm going to treat somebody who's profoundly ethanol intoxicated, meaning just good supportive care and just time to sober from the substance overall. I'm not going to do anything else. You don't need to be treated with fomepizole or with regular ethanol to try to block its conversion. You just need time to sort of metabolize this. Now, exactly as you say, isopropyl is found in a lot of products, and some hand sanitizers absolutely contain isopropyl as one of their key ingredients. And largely, it's replaced ethanol. Now, hand sanitizers used to contain a lot more ethanol, and that was one of the key ingredients in terms of how they worked. Now, the reason there was a move from ethanol to isopropyl was somewhat related to people ingesting the substance in an attempt to become regular old intoxicated, and they'd use it as an alternative source of alcohol. And so in a move to sort of combat that a little bit, we've sort of switched to these different substances and hand sanitizers to get there. Now, there was also a time where some of these hand sanitizers contained methanol, and we saw that a lot during the pandemic specifically. So during the COVID pandemic, we saw that there was a huge demand for hand sanitizer in general, and we saw import of hand sanitizer from various countries. And unfortunately, we saw some hand sanitizers come into the US that contained methanol. And this was a problem that had been long gone. And so by the time I started training in toxicology, or I guess by the time I started residency, people that drank, you know, mouthwash or hand sanitizer or any of these other kinds of things, we essentially didn't really worry about them. Like, you know, our old time attendings would tell us, we used to do things differently because they used to contain more toxic products. But for a long time during residency, we were just like, you drank hand sanitizer. We're not going to do anything. We're just going to watch and move on with life. But once the pandemic hit, all of a sudden with these imported hand sanitizers, we saw real deal methanol in them, and people were drinking this methanol or this hand sanitizer that contained the methanol and getting really sick. And unfortunately, we did see a lot of deaths from this. We had, you know, at least a few dozen that I know of across the country that actually died as a result of methanol toxicity from intentional hand sanitizer ingestion in an attempt just to become ethanol intoxicated. So these days, it's gone back down again, meaning that we see less hand sanitizers in the US that have any methanol component in them. And actually, the CDC and the FDA have a really good website where you can go and you can see the products that have been identified as containing methanol or not. And so if you're ever concerned, you have a patient on scene who has a hand sanitizer ingestion, if you have a smartphone with internet access, you can actually Google the brand that you see in front of you, and you can find the CDC or FDA website that contains this massive list, and you can check it against that list to see if it's one of the known hand sanitizers to contain methanol or whether it's one of the known hand sanitizers that we've deemed safe at this point.
Interesting. Yeah, I've personally had a lot of patients, probably more than I can count right away, that have just on the hand sanitizer topic, they've been found in bathrooms or, you know, public places, and they've broken open the publicly available hand sanitizer dispenser and they have the plastic bladder of the hand sanitizer and they're almost like a terrible camelback. But that's fascinating about the methanol. I did not know that.
So to summarize, Nick, we have three main toxic alcohols we need to worry about: methanol, ethylene glycol, and to a lesser extent, isopropyl alcohol. For each of these, they're going to be mostly accidental, maybe exploratory in the sense of pediatrics, or maybe in the sense of isopropyl alcohol and in an attempt to replace ethanol. The things that we need to worry about with methanol are vision loss, CNS problems. The things we need to worry about with ethylene glycol is kidney failure, crystal formation. The things with isopropyl alcohol are going to be, they're just going to be intoxicated for longer than you would expect. For each of these, mainly methanol and ethylene glycol, we're going to treat them with fomepizole, or if you, for whatever reason, at your hospital don't have access to fomepizole, then you can just give them alcohol and prevent the breakdown to the toxic metabolites. Is there anything I'm missing with that?
No, Ross, I think that's absolutely a fantastic summary overall. Those are absolutely the key points from each one of these substances. As you say, isopropyl, I worry about a lot less. the two other ones that we've talked about. They're both going to cause the acidemia that can be profound depending on how long since the time of ingestion. And then each one of those has their special caveat with the methanol. As you said, it's the CNS, it's the vision problems. For the ethylene glycol, it's the kidney problems and the crystal formation overall that leads to those kidney problems. And like you said, predominantly what we're going to do is treat them symptomatically and supportively in terms of like fluids, antiemetics, any airway protection we need due to their degree of intoxication. And then we're going to potentially treat them with ethanol or fomepizole to help block that conversion overall.
And the big things that are going to kill each of these patients is the acidosis. So if you are worried about airway management, you're going to refer to our episode 24 with regards to the physiologically difficult airway and severe metabolic acidosis.
Exactly. I've listened to that episode and I think you guys do a great discussion on it.
Thanks, Nick. And one other thing with regards to methanol is the dialysis. Why is that helpful?
Yeah. So in either of these ingestions, the ethylene glycol or methanol, dialysis is potentially a useful adjunct because dialysis can eliminate both the parent compounds as well as the toxic byproducts. The reason we think about it more in the realm of methanol compared to ethylene glycol is like, you know, if you are intoxicated on ethylene glycol and we get to you in time and you're not severely acidemic, your kidney function's okay, and we block you, meaning we give you either regular ethanol or fomepizole, you will eliminate the ethylene glycol in your urine. So as long as we keep you hydrated, you're just going to pee it all out. The half-life's not all that long. And so within a day or so, you're probably not going to have any ethylene glycol left, and we can probably safely discharge you from the hospital. The bummer with methanol is that there's only really two routes of elimination for methanol. Either the liver breaks it down, which we don't want, because if the liver breaks it down, i.e. the alcohol dehydrogenase breaks it down, you are going to turn it into the formic acid toxic byproduct, and you're going to suffer the consequences from it. The only other route of elimination for it is respiratory. So you have to breathe it out. And as you can imagine, we don't talk about breathing a substance out very often in the world of medicine. You can imagine that's a very slow process. So the half-life of methanol, depending on which paper you want to cite, when it's unblocked, meaning you have no ethanol, you have no fomepizole on board, the half-life of it is going to be somewhere between 6 and 12 hours, depending on what source you want to cite. And that's mainly because the liver is going to break it down. When you block somebody, the half-life of that substance goes above 50 hours, sometimes up to 70 some hours. And remember, it takes 4 to 5 half-lives to eliminate a substance completely from your bloodstream. So if you say, gosh, methanol has a 72-hour half-life, when you're blocked and you drank a bunch of methanol and you come into the emergency department, we give you fomepizole and we choose not to dialyze you, that means that every half-life is about 3 days long and you have to be there for 4 or 5 half-lives, which means you might have to be hospitalized getting fomepizole for 15 days before you're going to breathe all that substance out. And so a lot of people say, I don't want to be in the hospital for 15 days. And so sometimes the better part of valor is to dialyze you, because we can dialyze you in one session. We can get all the methanol off of you, and then we can safely discharge you from the hospital the next day, as opposed to keeping you over 2 weeks. Now, that sort of goes out the window when you're sicker. If you're more acidemic, you have more of the breakdown product in your bloodstream for either one of these, dialysis becomes a more viable option, because not only is it going to remove any parent compound that's left, but it's also going to remove these toxic byproducts from the bloodstream, and it has the added benefit that we can easily balance your pH with it. So dialysis, if you're sick from a toxic alcohol, regardless of which one you ingest, that's probably going to be a good option. Specifically in the case of methanol, even if you're not sick yet from methanol, we got to you in time, we blocked you with one of these substances, it still might be a better idea to dialyze you just so we don't have to keep you in the hospital for 2 weeks.
What about sodium bicarb?
That's a great question. So sodium bicarb, is one of those things that, you know, you can always consider it in somebody who's severely acidemic to try to help us from that perspective. And in terms of some of these toxic alcohols, there actually is some data that using sodium bicarb might help with some of the elimination overall. And so I have sometimes recommended sodium bicarb infusions in the setting of toxic alcohol just as a treatment overall. It's not something that I would say is strictly necessary, but it's something that might help people overall. And certainly, I think it has a low harm potential in these interventions. And then if you guys go listen to episode 24, I think Ross said, you may hear a discussion about using sodium bicarb in the acidemic airway.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks as always, Nick. If there is anything that you want pre-hospital providers to just remember and take home from this episode, tell us now to wrap us up.
When you encounter a patient that is intoxicated to purine, somewhere in the back of your mind, just briefly consider if you're worried about toxic alcohol at all. 99% of the times, everything's going to be as it appears, meaning that you all have encountered many intoxicated patients in the world. You're going to encounter many more as time goes on. And it's probably just good old-fashioned ethanol. But you have the opportunity to set the stage. And I will admit that most of the diagnoses I have made in the emergency department of toxic alcohol ingestion have nothing to do with my care or my diagnosis and all with the pre-hospital folks gift wrapping it for me. And I have to admit, even a lot of the sneaky cases I've seen have been solved because of the excellent pre-hospital care. Whereas I would have just said, oh, this patient was found down ethanol intoxicated, and I would have moved on with life, and I would have watched them for, you know, 18 hours in the emergency department to try to watch them sober until they got so sick that I'd say, wait a minute, what's going on with this patient? If it weren't for the excellent job of the pre-hospital providers who said, you know, something seems off about this, you know, let me do a little looking around the area. Gosh, I found this big empty bottle of ethylene glycol. And hey, doc, do you think this could be what's going on? I say, yeah, absolutely it is. And we get to the answer right away. And so when you see people who are regular ethanol intoxicated, consider this in the back of your mind. When you encounter patients who have called you because of a potential accidental ingestion, remember that it is almost impossible to know whether that patient is going to get sick or not just based on the amount they think they swallowed. Almost all those patients are going to need some sort of evaluation and monitoring in the emergency department before we can be confident that they are not going to get sick from these substances. And when you can, please bring in the bottles, because if we can see what concentration it is, if we can see exactly what substance we need to worry about, that can help guide our care overall. And when you encounter a patient who's getting sicker, 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 make sure you've listened to your episode 24 so you know how to deal with their airway.
Thanks, Nick.
Awesome. Thank you.